So, what are you doing in your day? Just arrived myself. He's fiddling around with all these things, getting set up. So, in the beginning of session of meditation, it's helpful to, as we've been encouraging, just to inquire, how is it now? What are we with as we come into this space, into this room, into the space of our awareness? So just spending a few moments connecting with what's present for us and taking a few breaths as we do so, breathing in to what our experience is, breathing out, and perhaps softening any resistance to what's present, the tendency to have the sense of moving away, even subtly, from the feeling, present moment experience, the sense of resisting. So all of that we just acknowledge. The unconscious relationship to the moment that where we feel it should be something else, something different. So coming into relationship with what's here and now directly, just spending a few moments. This is the foundation for our meditation practice. Feeling tones, the sensations, the sounds, the mood of the heart and mind. Do we feel peaceful, spacious? Or do we feel a bit restless, anxious, dull? We just notice, just noticing what's here. And as we begin to come into contact with this present moment experience, breathing, breathing with what's here and allowing for this attitude, this opening, this accepting. This is how it is. This is how it is here and now. So this attitude of this is how it is very helpful to develop, to cultivate in meditation and also in our daily life. It doesn't mean that we don't work to change how it is or to improve how it is, but sometimes we're so driven to keep responding to the moment from this sense of it should be different, that we can never actually attune ourselves to what's here, what's present, and therefore we can't really sense the depth, the underlying stillness, the underlying space, the underlying peacefulness, because we're constantly reacting, trying to change it, trying to move away from it. In Thailand, there's a great tradition of wearing amulets. People wear amulets to, they feel that they protect them. They wear these amulets and they go and get them blessed by monks. Amulets of pictures of monks or of the Buddha. And then they wear them and this they feel is their protection. Ajahn Buddhadasa, who initiated and developed Wat Swam Mok, which I think some of you have visited, he's passed over now, but a very well-known Thai Ajahn, he said, if you're going to wear an amulet, then you should have printed on it the phrase, this is how it is. Because this reality check is that very foundation of Dhamma practice. this sense of dukkha, or suffering, is the English translation. But the original word dukkha, du means something like apart from, ka is from the word akash, which means space, or the sense of being apart from the perfect, apart from the whole. This consistent sense of dis-ease, lack of ease, or unsatisfactoriness. This is the meaning of dukkha. This is the, in a way, this is the underlying state for many of us as human beings. This is our experience, the sense of dis-ease, never being at ease, never being able to rest anywhere. Ajahn Chah, our Thai teacher, said it's a bit like a dog that has this disease. It's called mange. It's a skin disease. And it runs everywhere trying to get rid of this sense of disease, scratching against a post here, running there. And one of his comments was that as human beings, we're like this dog. We just run everywhere trying to scratch and get rid of the sense of dis-ease. So in our contemplation, in our meditation, we instead of trying to get rid of this experience of dukkha, of dis-ease, we orientate, we have a reality check, we just notice this is how it is, and we begin to contemplate it, we begin to turn to it, to contemplate it. For the purpose of transcending it, being liberated from this dukkha. So just beginning in each moment, rather than feeling something's wrong, if I feel agitation or suffering, something's wrong with me personally, I've failed in some way because I suffer, something's wrong with the world, rather than projecting it out, it's the world that's wrong, or projecting it in, I'm wrong, we actually just more simply orientate ourselves to contemplate, this is how it is. There is this experience of unsatisfactoriness. There is this experience of struggle. And this we need to not, in this experience, we need to contemplate, not to repress, not to be shaped by, not to react to, but to begin to allow it into our field of awareness. So, in looking at this Samatha meditation, this Samatha meaning calming of the thinking processes, or the samadhi, the gatheredness, moments of being here, moments of presence. Looking at that as we cultivate this capacity to be here, and using that capacity to begin to open the awareness to contemplate what is actually our experience, the actuality of it, not how it should be. So often we approach the moments of our experience, the sense of ourself, with this feeling of how it should be. You know, it should be, I should be a certain way, you should be a certain way, the world should be different. So this reflection, this is how it is less idealized, less idealization. One of the difficulties in meditation is we have such ideals about how meditation should be and how we should be. We have an ideal of, you know, we sit here for a while, we should be peaceful. That's our ideal. We come on retreat, and somehow magically everything should disappear and mind should be still. We should feel holy, refreshed. And in fact, the reality can be that we just can feel the opposite. And then the ideal that we hold about meditation and the reality begins to create a war zone for ourselves, an internal struggle. Or we just feel a failure. I can't meditate. I've heard that so many times. I can't meditate. And because we have this idealization of what meditation is. So the reality is that a lot of meditation is just being willing to come to terms with the reality of being human, actually. The reality of that. Not to try and catapult ourselves into an idealized state, peaceful, calm, serene, don't feel anything that's disturbing me, clear, wise, compassionate at all times, don't make any mistakes. When in fact the reality is that as a human being, We're most of the time not like that. We're most of the time unclear, a bit doubtful, unsure, feel all sorts of things, feel the impressions from our personal history, our collective history, the environment we're in. The flow of life. And in the heart of that, there's a great unknownness. There's a great unknowing. As Ajahn Chah said, trying to find the certain in the uncertain. Life is uncertain. Things are uncertain. So to this is how it is in a way coming into contact with the reality of this human incarnation. It's like this. Sensitive, feeling, impressions from the heart, from the mind that flow up, memories, desires, fears, longings, confusion. And perhaps moments of peace. Moments of peace, so the peace, if we try and hold at bay this flow of life, the flow of the mind to maintain this peacefulness at the expense of really allowing ourselves contact with the reality of the moment, then we become quite split as meditators. These moments of peace, and then we hold off life. So being able to begin today to this vipassana is more reflecting, is yes, we establish ourselves in awareness, but we just open the mind, open the heart, open the awareness to contemplate how it is. Ultimately, as Ajahn Chah said, peace doesn't come from just being tranquil. The deeper peace comes from wisdom, from the ability to really see and understand and know all the different aspects of our being, all the different flow of life, to know this is how it is, here and now. So last night Kivisaya was talking about this classical teaching of the five hindrances. This is what we're knowing, this is what we're coming into contact with for many of us. If we're not, then that's great, we can radiate the enlightened energy out into the room. But we're probably in the minority, but for most of us the reality is that we're meeting one of these hindrances. You know, the first one, if you remember, this is tanha, kamma tanha. So tanha means thirst. Kamma means sense. Thirsting for the some kind of sensory contact that will give us this sense of completeness, this wholeness, because we feel the loss of it, we feel the loss of our wholeness, our completeness. And so this scanning of the mind, scanning the world for the right sound, the right sense, the right feeling, the right relationship, the right contact, the right place, the perfect place. We had a friend of ours who's a CEO, a businessman in South Africa, worked all year to go on holiday, the perfect holiday, worked really hard. He envisioned this perfect holiday with his wife, family, going to be beautiful. But when he got there, he couldn't enjoy it. He got there and he just felt so agitated, so irritable. Irritable with his wife, irritable with the place, critical of everything. So we project in the future some perfect ideal, and then when we actually do get there, when we get on retreat, I'll get to this space and I'll work everything out and I'll get peaceful and I'll go back refreshed, and we sit here and we just feel agitated and restless, and then we start thinking about, well, when I get back out of retreat and go and sit in the cafe with my friend, then I'm going to be all right. Then I'm actually going to feel okay. So then we sit in the cafe, we get back to Tel Aviv, and we meet up with our friends, and we have a meal, and it's very nice. But after a while, it starts getting noisy and loud, and then we go to work, and then we start thinking, God, I need to get back on retreat. And that's the craziness of this tanha. It just never rests. It never stops. It keeps driving us to the perfect place. And if you notice, I mean, I've been in many perfect places, many beautiful, stunning places in the world, and I've managed to be completely unhappy sometimes in the most beautiful surrounding. Can't enjoy it. You know, and I've also been in the most horrible situations, and sometimes really had moments of peacefulness and bliss. I remember once when I was in India and got so sick that I couldn't stand up even. And my friends put me on a train. I had bacillary dysentery, not a very pleasant thing, very Indian experience. And my friends hired a seat for me on a first class compartment, thinking, well, you know, at least I'll get a seat, not realizing it was the rush hour to Bombay. And all the seats were taken, and I found myself, I was so weak, and they went off into second class and left me thinking I was going to be all right. And I found myself, I couldn't stand, so I just lay on this floor of the Indian train. If you've been on an Indian train, you know it's not that pleasant. And amongst the peanut shells and the spittle, and people were stepping over me, and no one gave a damn. And I've never felt so blissful in my whole life. It was extraordinary, because I had no strength, no will. I couldn't shift anything anymore. I couldn't improve anything. I just had to totally accept the situation. And the acceptance, the just allowing, this is how it is. It was very sad when they had to haul me off at the other end. After 3 months of sitting on a meditation retreat in complete agitation, I finally clicked. On the floor of the train amongst the peanut shells. That's how it is sometimes, isn't it? You have these moments in the most unexpected places. And yet, you know, we've engineered these holidays on the African coastline, these beautiful beaches, these incredible, expansive, perfect beaches, and powerful waves and surf and dolphins. And, you know, you just sit there and feel a bit dislocated somehow. It's pretty, it's lovely, but not quite clicking somehow. Something in the mind still agitating, still worrying. So this tanha, this kamma tanha, this thirsting for the perfect experience. And as a meditator, we start to illuminate that rather than follow it, rather than be shaped by it, rather than judge it, rather than repress it. We bring the same attention, the attention we've been bringing to our breath, we bring that same quality of attention to contemplate. This is kama tanha, this is how it feels. And as Kirisara says last night, when we have vicha, moments of knowing, then it becomes a dharma. This is it's part of nature, it's the movement, the restless movement, the dharma unfolding, the dharma of kama tanha is like this. So when we see desire, we're not the desire. The desire, kama tanha, can never be sated. We can never reach the end of it. That's the illusion of it. The illusion of it is that we just, it's like that kid, you know, it's like, yeah, I promise Mum, if I can have this toy, I'll never ask for another one. And then the converse, the vipawa tanha, the aversion. When we've had enough, we've tasted enough, then sometimes we just get averse. You know, it's not necessarily full-blown hatred. That's not something that, you know, we have moments of that. But sometimes it's just this underlying unconscious resistance. Not really wanting to be here somehow. Just, you know, we're here, we're breathing, we're alive, and we just somehow feel ill will. The will, the mind is coloured by this sense of illness or resistance or negativity. Food's not right, people aren't right, the clothes aren't right, the place isn't right, I'm not right, nothing's right. This is quite a hard one to see, because in a way it feels so much like us. This is me. And then, you know, and usually they operate together. They're not wanting what's here, wanting something that isn't here, or operating together. So as a bringing mindfulness, moments of knowing, this is what it feels like. And then the third and fourth hindrance, the restlessness and the dullness. Mm-hmm. These two converse to each other, the feeling of bouncing off the walls. You sit here and the mind's just going crazy. Body feels agitated, mind just thinking about any old thing rather than be here, just fantasizing, agitated, restless. And then when we've had enough of that, we just start to feel dull, heavy, go back to bed, pull the duvet over and collapse. So this sort of the dullness of mind is like as we meditate, sometimes it's like a fog or a heaviness, but it can also again be coupled with this sense of just going dull, just not really wanting to be conscious. These aren't easy states to reflect on. We don't like them. They're unpleasant to us. I mean, desire isn't so unpleasant. Desire is exciting. It excites us. It makes us feel alive. These other states, the dullness particularly, is quite hard to actually get perspective on. And then the fifth hindrance is this feeling of doubt, confusion. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? What should I do? What's the answer? What's the right way? I don't know about this vipassana meditation. Maybe I should try something else. Maybe meditation is a bad idea. Maybe I should just go do yoga. I need to work with my body more. I like the qigong. Maybe I'll go and do qigong. and do Qigong and say, no, this is too complicated to learn, maybe I just need to lay on the beach for a while. We lay on the beach for a while, say, no, this is I'm not putting enough energy in, I need to really, really go practice. I'll take myself off down to some ashram in India and they'll really put me to it, put me through it. I don't know about the lay life, maybe I should go and be, you know, really commit myself, give up everything, go be a monastic. But there again, monasticism, that's not a Jewish thing to do. Maybe I won't do that, maybe go have a family. But I don't know if I really want to have a family. It's a lot of problems in that. And maybe I should, you know, go and... you know, it kind of gets a bit endless, doesn't it? You know, just like, and then the thing with doubt, we start thinking. There's this feeling I've got to think my way through this. You know, think, what the hell should I be doing here? You know, what's the best way? And so this afflicts us. These hindrances are called that which afflicts the mind, afflicts our well-being. It seeps away our ability to be well. It's not to say that these aren't true considerations. You know, what job should I do? Is this relationship working or not? But to have a moment of saying this is doubt, that's all, knowing. It's like the moment when the Buddha, under the enlightenment tree, he's sitting there and he's fully, but just before his full awakening, there's the whole display of Mara appears before him. All of these energies come and display themselves. You know, the temptations, the desires, the longings, the sense of duty, oh no, you should go back to your family, the memories of the past, the pleasures of life. All of it comes up in a full display in front of the Buddha sitting there under the Bodhi tree. And he doesn't get out his AK-47 and just shoot them. He doesn't sort of just kind of go there and chop Mara to pieces, you know, tread all over Mara. he just sits there and says, I know you, Mara. I know you. And Mara says, oh God, the Buddha knows me, and slinks away. So it's the power of the vijja, the dhamma eye, the wisdom eye, to just know this is how it is. We don't hate these forces. Ultimately, these energies, we start to transform. They become part of our vitality. But when they're not transformed, they just push us all over the place. So the first step is to have moments of just knowing this is doubt. This is what doubt feels like. This is thinking. This is just a thought rather than this is what I am. This thought is what I am. I don't know what to do. Should I, you know, should I go for that job or shouldn't I? Should I get married or shouldn't I? Or should I, what should I do about this relationship? Should I try and resolve it or just let it be? So just to be able to say this is doubt. And it's not saying that we don't come to those questions, but it's very different to come to those questions when we have some gatheredness, some rootedness in awareness, some capacity for wisdom, and then we turn the mind to those same questions, and then the responses can come from a very different place in the thinking mind, thinking itself in circles and in knots. Response can come from a more intuitive relationship to what's the right move to make or not to make in this moment. So in the Vipassana, the Vipassana meditation, sometimes called choiceless awareness, is not so orientated towards tranquility. It's in some ways, it's allowing ourselves to be disturbed. Not just to be disturbed to get agitated, but to be disturbed for the sake of cultivating this capacity for wisdom, to see the nature of things, rather than to fear the movement and just try and clamp it down. But it's hard to do that if we don't have any samadhi. It's hard to do that if we don't have some moments of gatheredness. Ajahn Chah would say, you don't need to have, you know, all the jhana factors in place to do Vipassana. You don't need to, you know, have Olympic concentration. So you just need the same level of concentration you would need to read a book. I mean, that's kind of doable, isn't it? You know, just to be able to hold steady your attention to this moment. That's in essence all the level of application that's needed, to hold steady to this moment. What's happening now? You know, this is restlessness. This is the mind in aversion. This is doubt. This is longing, wanting, and to see its nature, and to inquire, to investigate. How does it feel? Where does it feel in the body? Is there a sensation here? What's the feeling tone? What's the mental construct? Can I hold this without resistance to what is, without being shaped by what is? Can I hold this with awareness for the sake of insight? There's a term that's often spoken about in relationship to mindfulness, which in Pali is yoniso manisikara, which is sometimes translated as wise reflection. Yoniso manisikara. Yoni means womb, or primordial matrix is another translation. Manas is mind. It's the aspect. It's the aspect of mind that designates, that moves out and objectifies. In Buddhist understanding, mind is not just described as thinking mind. There's the aspect of mind called jitta, which is sometimes the heart or that which is affected, the sense of meanness almost, that's affected by the imprint, impressions of the world. And then there's an aspect of mind called manas. This is a very simplistic description for now, but the manas is that which moves out and designates. This is daytime, this is the hall, this is people, this is speaking. So that manas, that sense of that which designates, categorizes, that aspect of mind. So yoni is womb or matrix, manas is mind, sikara connected to the word kara or karma, to do or to make. So this yoni samanisakara literally means to bring or to make that aspect of mind, the aspect that's involved with mindfulness training, to bring that into the womb, into the primordial matrix, which is the awareness. So this reflectiveness, it's the fuller meaning is to bring what we're contemplating, the movement, the hindrances, the loves, the hates, the doubts, the thinking, the feeling tones, body sensation, to bring whatever appears back into this womb of awareness, this capacity to say this is how it is, and to reflect. So vipassana implies a reflective mind, that which can reflect, like a mirror, reflects things. Mind in ways like a mirror, it's reflecting. Ultimately, like, you know, it doesn't have, it's clear. The mind is reflecting what emerges within it, but it knows that within that reflective capacity there's that which is spacious, that which is untouched, that which is pure. This is the capacity, the quality of awareness of the mind. So this yoniso sati, mindfulness with yoniso manisikara, mindfulness and wise reflection, this is the tools of vipassana. These are the tools of vipassana. Meditation. So in our practice today, to explore this balancing, as Kivisar gave the analogy from the Buddha last night of two great oxen that pull the cart, one being the samatha, samadhi, meditation, which is the focusing, tranquilizing, calming, the bringing attention to an object like the breath, body sensation for the sake of gathering, and the other, the vipassana, to when there's some strength in our capacity to hold attention, to bring that quality of attention, to contemplate what's arising now, the dhamma of it, the way of it. It's like this. Or Ajahn Chah said it's like a candle. He says the samatha meditation, samatha just means these calming meditations. It's a bit like the wax of a candle. You don't just build a massive candle and never light it. You know, so sometimes we can get very attached as meditators, like I just, particularly if we're good at concentration, we just concentrate, get very, very peaceful. And we don't really want to reflect on anything because it's disturbing us. But he said it's a bit like then you've got a massive candle, but you never light it. You never light it, so you don't have any wisdom really. You can have a peaceful retreat, and then you go out, and within 10 minutes, when someone comes and speaks to you and complains about something, you just get blown away. Can't deal with anything. Can't deal with life. You know, what's the use of that? I mean, it's great. It's great to have some peacefulness, but if we can't irrigate it out into our lives, then it's a bit limited. And this isn't the purpose of the liberation of heart. It's the heart in touch with the world that's liberated, not in spite of the world. So the candle needs to be lit, and this is the vipassana. The inside is like having a flame. If we just try and strike matches and light, and we don't have any wax, we don't have any strength, and we just keep lighting the matches trying to see what's going on, and we can't see anything, we just get confused and muddled. So these both work together. Another way he described them was like the blade and the back of a knife. The blade of the knife cuts through. When you see it, you have a moment of being able to see, this is just doubt. This is just restlessness. It's like this. Without struggling with it, without judging it, without shifting it, it's like cutting through that. You cut through that, the wisdom sword. Like the Manjushri wisdom sword just can cut through. Can be liberated from the identification. And the back of the knife, that which gives strength to that clear seeing, is the samadhi. You know, the moments of being here, moments of being here. Moments of attentiveness. So this wisdom faculty that's the fruit of vipassana is very important for us. Ajahn Chah would say for most of us as Westerners, as you know, two, and this is very simplistically put, but generally you could say there's two ways to develop liberation. One's called jeta. Jeta Vimutti, liberation through concentration, through really, some people do have an aptitude for depth of samadhi practice, and then when they turn their mind to something, they see through immediately, nothing sticks. And then Panya or Prajna Vimutti, liberation through wisdom, and his comment was that for most of us as Westerners, that we have very busy minds, very complex emotional, psychological structures and histories. So that if we just rely on concentration, for most of us that's not going to work very, very much, because we have to somehow come to terms with this, these powerful mental, highly developed mental faculty, emotional complexity, psychological complexity. which, say, in northeast Thailand, a rice farmer would sit down to meditate and sit there for hours and not much of a problem, really. You know, just sit there peacefully, breathing in, breathing out. You know, that's not, generally speaking, that's not our experience, is it? I mean, you know, it wasn't my experience, not my experience. And, you know, a lot of confusion, a lot of restlessness, a lot of complexity, a lot of emotional content, a lot of reactivity. So this panya vimutti, to develop the capacity for wisdom through this wise reflection, not to, so today, if something comes and we say it's disturbing to us, you know, just to remember, say, well, this is how it is, isn't it? It's like this. And can we, rather than being disturbed by that, can we reflect on it? Steady our mind with our breath, with our body sensation, to be patient, to adjust our attitude, to have all the time in the world, as Ajahn Sumedho would say, to be with these orphans of consciousness, the things we don't really want to look at, to be with. To listen, to be patient with, to be kindly to investigate, and ultimately, Anutra sabbe dhamma, all dhammas are surmounted by wisdom, overcome by wisdom, by clear seeing, by the simple faculty of being able to, the awareness in the state of vijja or knowing, to be able to see this is how it is. I know you. I know doubt is doubt. I know desire is desire. I know aversion as aversion, restlessness as restlessness. And the Buddha said that one who knows these states for what they are without being shaped by them is like one who is free from prison, free from enslavement. Like one who's been on a long journey and been lost and found their way home. One who's found safety. So having gratitude for being human, because this human birth gives us the capacity, the very fuel and the stuff that we need to bring about this liberation. This, you know, this is it. This is what it's like being human. A bit messy, a bit complicated. But this is the very stuff that we can contemplate to bring about this fruition of insight, of wisdom, of liberation.